just lots of great memories of my summer days out at the Great Salt Lake.
We used to go out every Labor Day.
We'd go all day, take a picnic.
Most days we would ride our bikes from Magna.
We played around in the water.
Sad that my kids never got a chance to experience that.
Hello, we are first-year students at Utah Law, and this is our tort report on the Great Salt Lake.
My name is Isaac.
I'm Victoria.
I'm Claire.
And I'm Sydney. You just heard some of my family reflecting on their fond memories of the lake.
We will be discussing the current state of the Great Salt Lake, the threats the lake faces, and potential solutions to address the crisis. The Great Salt Lake is the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere and directly provides $2.5 billion in economic productivity each year and supports around 9,000 jobs locally. It provides food for more than 7.5 million birds who stop there during their migration along the Pacific Flyway or make the lake their home.
However, the lake is in uncharted territory. At 19 feet below its average natural level since 1850, it has lost 73% of its water and 60% of its surface area. Dr. Kevin Perry, an atmospheric scientist here at the U, spoke to us about the crisis the lake is facing.
You keep going down this path and when the lake hits a certain salinity threshold, it essentially dies. And in October of 2022, we were toes to the line for the ecological collapse. You could see it happening. The brine flies were disappearing. The brine shrimp were having trouble reproducing. And I was shocked at how quickly we got there. In 2018, I knew we were on a bad trajectory. I just had no idea that within 4 years, we would be on the verge of ecological collapse.
We spoke to Dr. Brian Munch, the board president of Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, who has studied the adverse effects of pollution on human health.
So we now have what I refer to as Utah's airpocalypse, and that is the four horsemen of our airpocalypse: increasing levels of ozone, winter inversions, wildfire smoke in the summer, and dust storms from the disappearing Great Salt Lake. The common denominator amongst all these different sources of air pollution is they all trigger a systemic inflammatory response, which is kind of the underlying mechanism of most chronic adult diseases like heart disease, lung disease, cancer. When we now understand that, say, in the case of cancer, 80 to 90% of cancer is precipitated or triggered by environmental exposures.
We've investigated the potential of tort law to aid in the restoration of the lake and mitigate the harms highlighted by Dr. Perry and Dr. Munch. Two things to consider when using tort law are who can sue and when they can sue. Under a traditional approach, only injured human plaintiffs may sue, and they may only sue after a harm is done, rather than preventing the harm from occurring in the first place. This may limit the ability of tort law to proactively preserve the Great Salt Lake. We spoke with Dean Kronk Warner about rights of nature, an approach which has been effectively utilized by several Native American tribes to grant legal personhood to natural entities, and by doing so has strengthened the protection of natural entities under the law. This legal doctrine could ameliorate some of the tort law's present deficiencies regarding the Great Salt Lake.
Another framework to look at is rights of nature, which could then intersect with torts, because rights of nature says that non-human entities, so rivers, that a river would have the ability to bring claims and to move forward. They intersect in a couple of different ways. So first is they're all different tools to try to kind of address modern environmental problems. But then also, if you have an entity that has been given its own rights, so for example, if the Great Salt Lake had its own rights, then theoretically the Great Salt Lake would then have the capacity to bring a torts action against individuals that were harming it. So I think there's a couple of different ways that you can see rights of nature and torts potentially intersecting.
Though these ideas have faced mixed success, particularly when adopted by communities outside of the indigenous tribal setting, Dean Kronk Warner expressed optimism that communities in the basin may be receptive to the rights of nature framework.
And I think the folks who are living here understand the importance of the Salt Lake and understand what we're facing with the drought. And so it's possible that there could be some appetite for a rights of nature framework at this particular time.
We spoke with two professors at Utah Law about the limitations of using tort law to address the Great Salt Lake crisis. First, Brigham Daniels, an expert on the Great Salt Lake.
There are some limitations that come to mind before almost anything else. One of the questions
things that I think you have to think about when you think about the Great Salt Lake is the chain of causation. You want to make sure that the person that's standing in the courtroom is the person that's responsible for your problem. In the case of the Great Salt Lake, I mean, you've got tens of thousands of farmers, you've got hundreds of municipalities. Who is responsible for the state of the Great Salt Lake? It's not to say you couldn't have a lawsuit, but it is, it's hard to ascribe, I think, a certain amount of liability to any one actor, even though we can see that collectively it's a disaster.
Next, we heard from Professor Tennille Brown, who teaches torts. She spoke specifically about the problem of government immunity in Utah.
States have been chipping away at liability for the last, 50 years, and Utah has been really aggressive in finding that anyone who's even kind of tangentially connected to state action is immune for a lot of tort suits. It has to usually be something much more than negligence. It has to be something more like gross negligence or recklessness for governments to be liable.
Acknowledging the limitations of tort law to address the Great Salt Lake crisis, we explored other legal and political possibilities for preserving and restoring the lake.
A suit has been filed against Utah state agencies by a Salt Lake City law firm and Earth Justice, along with local organizations. The suit alleges that the state of Utah, which holds the Great Salt Lake in trust for the benefit of the people of Utah, has failed to perform its duty under the public trust doctrine to maintain the lake at a functional level. We spoke to Scott Stern, an Earth Justice attorney representing Dr. Munch and other parties to the suit. He weighs in on the public trust doctrine.
We started asking around, local community and conservation groups and seeing if folks thought that there was some sort of solution that could prevent this, trust resource from effectively being destroyed within a couple of years. And so that led us to our clients and that ultimately led us to file this public trust suit. In general, I think that the public trust doctrine is underutilized and has been by environmental attorneys for a long time, but it's not in the common arsenal of weapons for environmental attorneys.
Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment is a plaintiff in the case. Here's the organization's president again, Dr. Munch.
Frankly, we have been very disappointed that the Utah legislature hasn't taken this more seriously. And it's not just that they have been unwilling to craft public policy to address it. They are also, in many cases, crafting public policy to make it worse. We know that the West Side is disproportionately impacted, and the West Side has people who are economically disadvantaged. We also know that they're closer in proximity to the Great Salt Lake. They're undoubtedly going to be disproportionately exposed to things like that as well. I will say somewhat candidly that because of the intransigence of the Utah legislature on these kinds of issues, we are looking more and more towards the courts for redress of our attempts to try and improve public policy in this arena. So that's why our group is one of the handful of groups that is basically suing to force the state's hand into changing public policy enough to save the Great Salt Lake.
Though the suit discusses public health risks extensively, it also covers risks to migrating birds at some length. Dr. Perry, who is not a party to the suit, expressed skepticism about an approach focused on environmental harm rather than risks to public health.
Scientists have been worried about the birds for 20 years. Nobody seems to care about the birds. I mean, really, a million birds die. Oh, yeah, so what? But when I see my kid having to breathe dust coming off the Great Salt Lake, I'm calling up my legislator.
Though torts and the public trust doctrine may provide limited remedies, several of our interviewees emphasize that the most promising strategy may be to pursue policy change in the legislature. We spoke with Elizabeth Waite, a former Utah state legislator and current advocate for the Great Salt Lake. Elizabeth walks along the lake most mornings and talked to us about her views on the legislature as an avenue for helping the crisis.
I was out there one time and my mother called. I answered the phone and was walking around where she used to swim. Right now, we can create policy to turn it around. And that's never happened before. And we don't have to let our lake go away. We can actually help it flourish again. If we go by what policymakers seem to want now, they actually refuse to set a goal for the Great Salt Lake level. Policymakers on every level look at the Great Salt Salt Lake in terms of what is its monetary financial benefit. In my part of Utah, West Valley, and 15 minutes from the Great Salt Lake, and downwind from the winds from the Great Salt Lake that blow over the tailings pile of Kennecott. It's got a number of heavy metals coming over my legislative district that is 26% school-age kids. I think our legislature does a lot to avoid dealing with a lot of the people, family-oriented impacts of the Great Salt Lake. I think that's a legislature not doing its job by choice. The way people behave around the lake is going to make a difference for it. What is your city doing about being a trendsetter and a model for getting more water to the lake? Our city can be fundamental and instrumental and take a lead.
Professor Daniels, who is actively involved in Great Salt Lake preservation efforts, emphasized that he was hopeful about working with the Utah legislature.
As far as what I think the solution is, and I certainly understand that there are other people that think this is a fool's errand, but I put all of my eggs in the basket of working with government leaders, trying to convince them to enact laws.
Dr. Perry works with the Utah legislature as part of the Great Salt Lake Strike Team, which describes itself as a primary point of contact for policymakers as they address the economic, health, and ecological challenges created by the record low elevation of the Great Salt Lake.
Legislators always do what's pragmatic, and they tend to do what's easy. And that's what they've been working on so far. But the people of Utah have spoken, and they do not want to see the lake die.
Though legislative action has been slow, policymakers are starting to act. The governor has appointed a Great Salt Lake commissioner who has been working with the legislature to implement solutions like purchasing water rights. Thus far, elected officials are responsible for most tangible progress. However, there is still a long way to go. This is where litigants and grassroots organizers can play a role.
Once policies are put in place, environmental litigation may protect and compel progress. This process may or may not involve tort law. Grassroots organizations like Grow the Flow, Save Our Great Salt Lake, and the Youth Coalition for the Great Salt Lake can continue to educate policymakers and mobilize community members. A combination of these approaches is the most viable path for saving the Great Salt Lake. As a society, we must shift our mindset to cherish the lake. In the words of writer Terry Tempest Williams, we must exercise our collective capacity to mobilize love.